when we talk about orchestras, I suppose we're talking about an unnatural phenomenon to some degree. It's something which came about rather accidentally, in a sense, in the 18th century. The orchestra that we describe now as the one familiar to us, and was brought about by rather wealthy people suddenly deciding that the small groups they had could be extended. They found they enjoyed large sounds, and sounds got larger and larger in the 19th century, got even larger again with great concert halls. And I think the modern listener and viewer or person who goes to concerts, they're primarily looking for, you know, the excitement of a big sound, which can also contrast with very intimate sound.
Dr. Gerard Victory, Director of Music at Radio Telefish Éireann.
What you're really looking for is a largish group of people, all of them fine musicians, which they must be good musicians, but they must also have a wish to work in concert, to work together, to subordinate themselves individually to the total result. And they must have an esprit de corps, a certain pride in the group. They must have a discipline. They must have a common purpose. And really, some of these things are not as easy to obtain as you might think. They're contradictions in terms, because if you're a good performer and spent a lot of years learning an instrument, I think you will end up feeling that you want to show off, do your own thing, be a soloist, and at the same time, you've got to subordinate yourself. I think this is, if you like, countered or resolved, the dilemma is resolved by a very good conductor is the most important ingredient, a personality who impresses this objective on people, gets them to subordinate it and get pride and joy out of subordinating their personal thing, as it were, their personal quirks and mannerisms in playing. And really, one is working all the time to establish that rapport between a conductor, not necessarily only one conductor, but certainly the principal conductor and the players, to achieve a unified objective where their own talents are subordinated to this effect. And at the same time, they don't do it grudgingly, but get a lot of pleasure and enjoyment out of it, which is very important.
In Ireland, our symphony orchestra started in a very small way. Terry O'Connor, one of its first members, recalls.
They started off not with the idea of an orchestra at all. As far as I can remember, there were four people involved, and there was an advertisement in the paper, and Rosalind Duss applied, and Eileen McNeice applied, and Kathleen Andrews applied. And as far as I know, it was just two violins and a cello and a piano. Mm. I'm not quite sure whether the piano came at that stage. At all events, eventually, Kitty O'Callaghan.
Where did you rehearse?
They were in the GPO.
Oh, I see.
From the very beginning, they were in the GPO. And I wasn't there at that time, and they went. They had this trio or quartet or whatever you call it going. And I had a call from Dr. O'Brien to know.
He was the musical director, Vincent.
He was the musical director, yes, from the beginning. Mm. He was appointed. And of course, Vincent O'Brien had an awful lot to do at that time at the cathedral. He was the organist there and choir master and everything.
The Palestrina.
Anyhow, Palestrina. And he asked me to come in and talk to him, see. So I went in and we had a long chat. I was at that time, I don't know, I probably was playing in a picture, as I can't remember exactly what I was doing. But anyhow, I said to Vincent, but what about a viola? Mm. Because I said, you can't have a string quartet without a viola. Mm-hmm. So that was an idea.
Mm.
And
so it began from very small.
It began from very small beginnings, you see. And Maud Aiken was the first viola. Maud Davin, as she was. No, she was Maud Aiken, I think, then. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
And it was quite a while. And then Vincent was getting more and more dissatisfied with how it was going on. And they decided to get a small orchestra going.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, they had people ready to sponsor programs.
Terry O'Connor became the first leader of the symphony orchestra. and she was one of several women who have had that distinction. At 83, she listens to the RTSO of today.
Actually, at the moment, I think the orchestra is absolutely first class, and I've heard very, very fine performances, as well as some not so good, but mostly I get great pleasure from listening to them and seeing how it has developed. Of course, they now have several conductors. This was one of the problems, I think, always, if you're trying to run an orchestra or even a small chamber orchestra, getting somebody who has imagination as well as the direction and the authority that's necessary for conducting.
As the orchestra was gradually built, musicians came from many sources. Richard Purse joined to play the bassoon.
I was in the army for about 14 years, from 1923, and straight into, on an invitation from Dr. Kiernan. And then I went in to the orchestra then, against Colonel Brassey's wishes, and his assistant director, Sarzweig, he was advised me all along to go in, not to mind Colonel Brassey. And the two of them were, you know, one was against me going, and the other was advised me looking forward to the future, do you see? So I went in, although the money didn't make a great difference. I was earning up around the £5 mark in the army, and I went into Radio Ireland then, and it was much the same, I only worked a few hours a day.
It's unbelievable now, you know.
Yes. About £5 a week it was, and then there was a tax stop there was that.
That was the Radio Ireland
orchestra. Yes, it wasn't a full orchestra.
It was the studio orchestra.
Yeah. Well, before that, I played at the very first place down in Denmark Street.
Oh, yes.
Over Lee's furniture place. I played there, and there was a group, Terry O'Connor's Cleary's Instrumental Trio. And she used to bring in a couple of fellas from the army, woodwind players, bassoon, clarinet, and oboe. And we used to climb up the couple of flights of stairs and we do our stuff. And I think we used to get £5 a rehearsal, £5 own money, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, we had to wait months for that. It had to go to the army, and we were paid from the army by cheque.
Alice Brough was in the Gate Theatre Trio before joining the violins.
Well, around about the time the Italians came, six or seven Italians, and Renzo.
Yes, and Renzo Marchioni. And he was a marvellous thing. He still writes to you.
Oh, he had such a dignified presence, too, when he came out to lead the orchestra.
Yeah. He was a nice man, wasn't he?
Oh, very nice man. Very nice to work with.
Mm. He still writes
to you. I don't
think
he ever really had a cross word with anybody.
Yes. Very dignified.
Oh, very. Wonderful technique.
Yes. Well, did he... Can you remember? I can't remember very much about Renzo because I think I was in England. But did he pay much attention to the back desks?
Well, he never sort of pounced on anybody.
Yes.
But he studied his own part so well that you feel compelled to...
And was he meticulous about the bowing? And
oh, yes.
Christine Fagan, a cellist, recalls an interesting development.
The first person that introduced modern music, and I'm not speaking about Irish music, was Martinon.
Jean Martinon.
He introduced the orchestra to modern music. And as the first Lemaire and all that, they were new to us.
They were.
And then the next person to come along and do it was Jean Aurède.
Oh, yes, I've forgotten about him.
Jean Aurède. I don't know whether I'm pronouncing his name correctly or not. And then Archie Potter. And, of course, Archie Potter, well, that was in latter years. I mean, that wasn't so desperately...
But there were no indigenous Irish composers, shall we say, at that time.
No.
Except Hamilton Harty, of course. I do remember.
Well, I mean, Hamilton Harty and Field.
And John Field.
John Field.
It was with the Wild Geese. There was Jeff Moran, of course. And you remember the... Oh, yes. Marvellous concert in the Capitol.
Yeah.
And Jack Moran's
And his symphony, and his violin concerto.
Nancy Lord played. Performance of that violin.
Yes, Nancy Anne played it very well.
Played it very well, yes.
And it was very good.
Yeah.
But that type of music didn't seem to take on with the Dublin public at all.
It didn't.
I think they just wanted the natural Irish music.
Mm.
And like we did a lot of Irish music arranged by Dr. Larche.
Mm.
We did a lot of Irish music arranged by Dr. Vincent O'Brien.
Mm.
And at that time, I think the minister was Mr. Little.
Paddy Little, that's right.
And
yes.
He was very keen to extend the orchestra.
Mm.
But they hadn't got the players here. They hadn't got enough.
Mm.
And this is how it started, to get the continental players over.
Yes.
You see, they started with a few.
Well,
and then
when you were in the orchestra, Christine, when you were cellist in the, with Clive Twelpries was leading
and I
the
was
cello section, and you were deputy leader, and that was in Henry Street.
That's right.
In the GPO.
Yes.
And do you remember there were a lot of conductors coming from the Army School of Music? There was Michael Bowles, there was Arthur Duff, there was Dermot O'Hara, Jim Doyle.
Yes. And the first one in was Jim.
Jim Doyle.
And he was made lieutenant.
Mm.
And then after Jim Doyle came
Dermot O'Hara.
No, Dermot O'Hara, and he was made a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Dermot O'Hara came Michael Bowles.
Yes.
And he was made a lieutenant.
I see.
And then, as there were two, I don't think there were very many more years than about 2 to 3 years with us, but they got their experience that way, and then they were made captain.
Yeah,
you see, whatever the rank is coming up in the
but
army.
All that time that these were coming backwards and forwards from Portobello to Raddy Wearne, the orchestra never played in public, did it?
Oh well, Michael Bowles, we must give Michael credit for.
Well, that was the
symphony. He started with Mr. Little to try and get the symphony a full.
These were in the
orchestra.
These are the Mansion House.
Now, that's when I was leading, because Clyde Twelvetrees was out sick a lot.
Mm.
You must remember,
he came
from the Halle.
Yes.
He'd retired from the Halle, and it was marvellous for me, because I started with him. He was my teacher.
Yes.
And I felt sort of very humble and sort of quiet, you know, having my own professor beside him. I thought it was a terrific honour, which, of course, it was.
Yes.
Jean Noel was thrilled down to get him over, because she was mad about him.
Yeah.
And we had him for quite a few years, and then he got into bad health.
Mm.
And he was in and out and in and out, and I was more leading then.
Michael Bowles, a conductor with the Army, joined RE in 1941 as acting director of music and conductor of the Symphony Orchestra. And since money is always short for orchestras, he recalls an incident at that time.
Mr. Joe Cremins and Seamus Brennan. Joe Cremins was the secretary.
He was in the interim department
of Post and Telegraphs then, and we sat at a table across from the secretary of the Department of Finance and two officials. And at one stage of the early negotiations about the orchestra, Seamus Brennan said to Sean Moynihan, he said, "Sean, you're not very constructive." And Sean said, "It's not my business to be constructive." Now, it's a point of view in the Department of Finance that I have great sympathy with, and I agree that it's not their, it's their business to keep control over.
They must know where the money
characters
is going.
Like us, and but at the same time, I must say that I found them permissive. The big hurdle we had to get over was that previous to my coming to Radio Ireland, they used to give the occasional symphony, celebratory concert, perhaps 2 or 3 in the year at the most. And it didn't work very well. Indeed, the year before I came, there was a concert with Hamilton Harty conducting and Solomon playing either the Emperor or the Tchaikovsky piano concerto. And they couldn't give away the tickets. And that would be in the mind of the Department of Finance.
And where was that held?
This was held in the Gaiety Theatre.
In the Gaiety?
And perhaps it was just before the war. And when I came, what I was able to get over with the help of Cremins and O'Brien was that if you announced 6 concerts, the publicity from one would carry over into the next, and it probably a safer venture to give six than one. And the Department of Finance accepted that idea. Mm. But we weren't able to do any celebrity concerts at that time because the war was on.
But you had the public concerts in the Mansion House.
We had the public concerts in the Mansion House, and the first concert I remember, the celebrity was Charles Lynch, a very good celebrity indeed, and I remember James Johnston came down from the top of his career at that time as
Cyrus
a tenor.
Smith and Phyllis Selig.
And we had, expanded, we found we were able to bring over artists from London. We had a very good relationship with Ibsen Tillett. You see. And
Myra Hess was here, wasn't she?
Myra Hess, Harriet Cohn, Beatrice Harrison, that gave the first performance of the Elgar Cello Concerto. Mm. And we had practically all of them that time. There was, and then later on, we had, when the war was over, we began to bring in French musicians and that. But the point was that we were allowed a very small budget to begin with. And then we were overspent a little. And
what did the orchestra cost in those days? Can you remember?
I can tell you that we were allowed for the first series of concerts. The hire of the hall, which was only £5, the Mansion House, we had to pay the extras. That's to say, making the orchestra up to more than 50 from 26 people. That had to come on the cost of the concert. The other cost, the fee of the solo pianist, the publicity, the program cost, and that we were allowed £90 for that, concert. And we gradually overspent and apologised. And, I must say that we had sympathy in the Department of Finance, but we had to justify every expansion bit by bit.
Yeah.
And the main thing in the end was we were obviously producing regularly full houses and had to ration the sales of tickets. And that then went to the capital. But the point was that we got what
you wanted
from the Department of Finance.
What you asked for. Yeah.
Yes.
A man who was much concerned with finance was Lorne O'Brien, then Secretary of the Department of Posts and Telegraphs. Was it difficult to get money?
Yes, I think, of course, that we... times were still difficult, very difficult, after the war. Mm. But fortunately, in another point of view, of course, things were very satisfactory, because after the war, of course, there were plenty of musicians around who could be gotten for very little. In fact, the more I think of it, the more I'm amazed, really, at what we got away with for some of the musicians.
The sort of money we're paying.
Yes. I remember, for instance, a man like Jean Martineau, who made quite a hit when he came here.
He was a conductor,
He was here for some months. And I remember it fell to, I don't know who actually did the negotiating with them, but I was in on it in some respects. And he was being given really peanuts, really, you know.
Can you remember the figure in your card?
Well, I can't really, but I would be surprised if I was paying him more than £40 a month.
Good heavens, it's incredible.
Well, of course, we must always think again back in terms
pound
of...
Was worth more then.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Than it is now.
Absolutely, yes.
What did you find the...
he had very little, relatively little.
He
had just come out of prison. He'd been a prisoner of war. He'd been
a prisoner of war during
the war. Mm-hmm. He came here originally, I think, as a substitute for Charles Munch.
Munch was to have come,
to one of these Sunday concerts. Mm-hmm. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And rather late, we... that Munch wasn't coming, but he was sending this pupil of his. And I think Martineau got some considerable value out of Dublin, apart from the money, because he obviously hadn't been up before, standing before an orchestra for a long time. He'd been a prisoner of war.
Well, he told me himself that he learned all the Brahms symphonies.
Well, I'm sure he was practicing really on the orchestra. He grew up with the orchestra very much, didn't he?
And of conductor Michael Bowles, he says.
I must say, in fairness to Michael Bowles, that he was very active in some very splendid ways. I think it was he who put up the idea to me, which I very gladly accepted, to start those summer schools, those professional summer schools in Dublin.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And they were set up really to cure a rather chronic situation in which there were very few up and coming young players, mm-hmm. instrumentalists, mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. And we brought people in. Perhaps it might have followed from that after some time that some of the best people would go abroad, as indeed I think some of them did. Didn't Geraldine O'Grady really go as a result of the
summer schools?
Some of them,
she went to Paris.
I think the O'Brien girl went. Mary O'Brien went. She went to Paris too. She was in the conservatoire in Paris with Geraldine O'Grady, I think. And we were encouraging them. We were trying to do the best we could.
Did you hope then that these people would come back to the orchestra, as Geraldine did, in fact, and become leader?
Oh, yes. Well, of course we did. Yes, we hoped we'd get some of them back anyhow. We were only at the beginning of things when, again, another economy campaign erupted, and we had to cut out those summer schools, which was a great loss.
They were terrible losses.
And we went back then to the old business of an occasional summer school in UCD or something of that sort.
Well, there was a summer school, as far as I remember, of conducting in Phoenix Hall. Do you remember that?
That was part of the summer school.
The same scheme.
That was part of the same scheme.
It
was exactly.
Very, very good, that one.
It was, of course. We had Martineau, and we had Ischerstedt.
Ischerstedt, yes. Schubert was here at the
and
time.
And these two men, of course, became really very eminent.
Very
didn't
famous,
they?
Yes. Very famous.
They were very good men.
Rabather Farrakhan, a later controller of radio.
I remember Michael Bowles very well. Worked with him for a number of years. Michael Bowles, of course, has considerable organising ability, and is remembered for the way he, as the first full-time director of music and conductor, the way he organised the music department and the public concerts.
The Symphony Orchestra, in its several stages, has had many homes, from Denmark Street to the top of the GPO, to the Phoenix Hall and St. Francis Avis Hall, before moving last year to the National Concert Hall. Among the many developments in the years between, however, was Faulkner O'Hanrahan, who became director of music after Michael Bowles, and he set out to establish a second orchestra.
I was firmly convinced that one body of players could not meet the varied needs of broadcasting in the years ahead. And about the Light Orchestra, apart from its special contribution to programmes, it opened up an entirely new field for Irish composers and arrangers. And over the years, a varied repertoire of works commissioned, especially in the field of Irish music. Even in the realm of the symphonic music, I always encouraged this. And in fact, I made a point of having, if possible, one Irish work, at least, in every public concert. And I recall also that it was I who initiated the Carolan Prize for Composition, a competition which yielded some very interesting works over the years. Now, I firmly believed in the importance of having a direct contact between the orchestra and the public, and also in having concerts at regular times so as to encourage the concert going and the concert listening habit. Now, over a number of years, the Phoenix Hall concerts lay the foundation, I believe, for the resumption of public concerts. And they also, and this is something important, they established a rapport between the orchestra and the audience, and I think brought the best out of the musicians. The musicians were no longer playing to an unseen audience, and to my way of thinking, at least, this was something very, very important.
Many famous continental musicians began to come to Dublin, among them Stravinsky, the great Stravinsky, and he is remembered by Leo Donnelly, a long-time manager of the orchestra.
One had to be conscious of this fact, and one had to excuse the little foibles which men of his calibre take unto themselves. But all things being equal, it was one of the great joys of my life. I had the pleasure of meeting him at the airport when he arrived. That was part of my duties. And he arrived, as I say, en prince, with his wife, Madame Stravinsky, with his agent, Madame Ampanoff, and with his assistant conductor and biographer, Robert Kraft. They stayed for a period of, I think, of about a week. They were in, there was that time there was a festival had been arranged by RTÉ, of Radio Éireann as it then was, in the Delphi Cinema in Abbey Street. A concert on the Sunday, a concert on the Thursday, and a final concert on the following Sunday. The first concert was the Stravinsky concert, in which Robert Craft conducted the first half, which was The Fairy's Kiss. And then Stravinsky himself took over after the interval with the Von Himmelhoch and the Symphony of Psalms, in which, by the way, Junior Redden and Charles Lynch were the solo pianists. But that was the event. But it's the time of his presence in the city which caused me the most joy and no bit of distress. There were several engagements arranged for him, one of which was an interview, if that's the right word, it isn't, a meeting with the President of Ireland, the then President of Ireland, Eamon de Valera. And the meeting was arranged, shall we say, for 11 o'clock in the morning. And a small party was invited, Stravinsky and his wife, and one or two people from Radio Éireann. And it was my job to collect him from the hotel and take him up to the park, and then to wait until the interview was over and take him across the park to the American Embassy, where a luncheon party had been arranged. I told Stravinsky that I would call for him on the day at 10:30, giving us a half an hour to go to the Oris and Uthron. You could do it at that time. When I arrived, he was waiting in the foyer, and I said, is Madam ready? Oh, she's gone off to get her hair done. Collapse of stout party. What was I going to do? The President of Ireland was waiting on Stravinsky. Stravinsky was with me. It was time to go. I had to make the decision. I couldn't. Yeah. There was no court of appeal. So I said, OK, let's go.
Oh, good for you.
And we went. And he had his appointment. And when I'd, somewhere during the course of the morning, Madame Stravinsky turned up. Not in Oris or Uachtaráin, because by that time the interview was over. But at the embassy, where there was a luncheon party. Incidentally, there was a photograph taken, which I remember on one of the newspapers, I think it was the Irish Times, of the that meeting between the two men.
Between de Valera and Astrid.
Between the president, yeah. And the composer.
Yeah, that's right.
He was an amazing character.
Tibor Paul was director of music at that time.
Tibor Paul was the man who was responsible for people of his eminence coming to this country, people like Menuhin, Rostropovich, Stravinsky, and many solos of equal calibre.
And what kind was it? What sort of attendance did you have at those concerts?
Unhappily, that concert itself was well patronised, the Stravinsky concert, but the other two concerts during the week, which formed part of the music festival, were poorly attended. In fact, one of them had to be cancelled for lack of public support.
That was Van Cliburn and
No, the Van Cliburn one
went ahead. But what about Milstein?
The one in Milstein and Fistolari in the middle of the week had to be abandoned.
Fistolari, I mean, it's incredible. I mean,
incredible.
Absolutely incredible.
You see, drop a pin now and they'd come from
the ends of the earth.
They'd come from all over the island to see and hear those people.
Yeah,
times have changed.
A conductor who came in 1968 and subsequently toured with the orchestra, Albert Rosen, comments.
In one sense, it's full harmony in the leading desks.
Yeah.
And all of them are, it seems to be, are going very well together. And it is the same spirit, high intelligence, full technical equipment, and a wonderful mood for a musical world.
And how do you think the strings balance with the wind?
This is a lasting problem which varies with the composition of the strings players. Mm-hmm. When I arrived, there was more strong players which have been much less in ensemble. There have been a couple of Hungarians, French, and which have been outstanding players perhaps, but not so good in ensemble as we have now. Mm-hmm. But the sound production of a string ensemble can be modified very much by rehearsing it.
What will be the effect of moving into the National Concert Hall?
I stopped to believe too much in acoustics, because what decides is the playing. If an orchestra plays well, it will sound very convincing in the so-called bad acoustics and will sound the same in good.
Mm-hmm.
An orchestra which doesn't play very well will sound a bit better in good acoustics, but actually the real thing won't change much.
Yeah. Because it seemed to me in the last couple of concerts that I heard from you in the Gaiety,
yeah,
were very much better, that you had seemed to come to terms with the Gaiety acoustics. I don't know how you did it, but it was very much better.
No,
I'm
not so sure about this, as Gaiety, as a theatrical acoustics, has the effect that compact music, like, say, all operatic overtures, sound very well because they are written for a pit orchestra. With the imagination by these composers that they have to fill the sound by a lot of brass and wood and thick string composition. Whereas pieces which are written with a fine hole in mind, like already Mahler has had better holes for his symphonies, are much more in lines and not so compact and accordic.
Yeah.
So here is lays the difference. So it is from time to time it seems to be better or worse, and also the playing is what is deciding.
Yeah. Well, do you think that they know that they're really an all-purpose orchestra? They're a radio orchestra, they're a public orchestra, shall we say, a national orchestra, and they're also an opera orchestra. How do you feel about them having three dimensions as well?
Marvelous. This is the best an orchestra can do.
It's very good for them.
That they play so many styles, and that they are never really just in one level, but that they do all this. The best for an orchestral player is to listen to a singer when he sings with him the aria. And this can apply also in many cases in symphonic music. Because after all, this music is the same, but just the function is different. Of course, the flexibility in opera is much wider than it seems to be in symphonic music. Of course, if you do a bit of this operatic glamour in a symphony, it doesn't matter at all. It gives it much more flavor.
Yes, I see. Well, would you think that the orchestra as it stands now is, for our size of country, is as good as you'll get? For this size of country, and for the money that is being paid, is available.
I think this is a wrong comparison. Small countries can have excellent orchestras. Mm. Big countries have poor orchestras. It depends much more on the technique, how it is run, on the intention, and on the general cultural background of this particular country. It's hard to give comparisons. Say, very rich countries have not very great orchestras, I won't say which, but this country could humbly say do much more. Not so much in the money sense, but in the general cultural attitude, which is very high.
Principal conductor of the RTESO today is Colman Pierce, and the leader is Audrey Park, the fourth woman to hold that post. Geraldine O'Grady was an earlier leader.
From my first three years as leader, we were in the Phoenix Hall. And we were all very distressed when we moved to the Francis Xavier Hall.
Why were you distressed?
Because it was such a dreary place to play in. And I know for a fact that every morning, you know, when I would wake and realise that I had to spend 5 or 6 hours a day in this hall, it used to depress me. I mean, a cloud would descend upon me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't...
But do you think it's
really
any better now?
Well, Thibaut Paul at the time did what he could with it. Mm. But I don't think it's any better. Now, maybe it's just me.
Yes.
But I have never liked the hall, you know, at all.
Yes, yes,
I've never liked it.
And she says of her leadership...
I was appointed, actually, it was quite a shock to me because I didn't really envisage orchestral playing at all at that stage, because my whole life was geared towards solo work.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember Faulkner O'Hanahan, who was music director at the time, invited me in for a chat. And then he said that they would like me, they meaning, I suppose, the authority at the time, would like me to take up leadership of the orchestra, and I was flattered, but I was a bit worried at the time because I was very young.
You were very young. Yes.
I was very young. You see, I was only in my middle 20s, and I felt that with all these, you know, older people, that they mightn't take to.
And you hadn't really played around, as it were, in orchestras at all.
Well, I had actually. I'd done a lot of orchestral work because I was leader of the International Students Orchestra
in
Paris, and we had done a lot of touring with them. I'd toured, you know, Germany three times, and we'd given a lot of concerts in Paris. We gave regular concerts about every 2 weeks. So we'd done quite a lot of repertoire. And, of course, in the conservatory then, we did an awful lot. It was compulsory.
Yes, you had to do it.
We did a lot of
orchestra. Well, how did you find Radu Wern when you came to it? The orchestra, I mean.
Well, I think, you know, myself, that period, 62 to 64, was a kind of a golden era in music in Dublin. because, and I would, I, my own opinion is that this came from Tibor Paul, because as you remember, mm-hmm. he was a most enthusiastic mm-hmm. person and very dynamic, and he generated enormous enthusiasm mm. and energy and among the musicians and yes. among the public. He had yes. great charisma. True. And there was a great excitement among the concert-going public and among the shopkeepers and mm-hmm. the ordinary people in the street.
And how does Dr. Gerard Victory, Director of Music, see the future?
I feel that in Ireland, the tendency will be more and more for the symphony to be a personal, visible entity as well as a broadcasting one, in perhaps some greater measure. The opening of the concert hall, which is one of the best things that has happened in music in Ireland in recent years, certainly will accelerate this process, and it is so doing. What our task will be, I think, is that the special tasks of our own orchestra will not be too greatly overlooked. There is a tendency that in putting on the great spectacle, which I think will be the future of symphony in the world generally, more towards this maybe than even in the past. And this has happened in films, for instance, which have gone through the same sort of process, perhaps a bit sooner, that the thing which survives is the very major spectacle, which draws people from their homes away from television, obliges them to part with a few pounds to enjoy something that is unique. I think we will and are moving towards that, and its future and survival will depend a good deal upon this. And I think side by side with it, in such a small country, we must not overlook the marvellous work which this orchestra has done in developing Irish composition, in encouraging Irish soloists, in reaching into the homes of everyone, in its own performances, in its documentaries, in things linked with it by way of talks and illustrations, making people aware of all types of music in Ireland. This has been a great achievement, and we wouldn't like to see this falter. But I would say that that continuance will depend to a great extent on increasing impact, both visually and in spectacle, and in the appeal it can make to very involved audiences, really anxious to pay and support such a thing for the pleasure and thrill and excitement they're going to get out of it. That is the principal trend I would see, and I hope that economic difficulties which do exist will not impair it. I feel if the effort is good enough, they won't. We'll be right back.